Good morning. So last time we talked about out-of-order processors and how they dealt with hazards, at least one way they could deal with hazards. We mentioned that, well, you know, this is more complicated than our pipeline processors because we have sort of new types of hazards. We have things like we can write an old version of a value after we write the newer one because, well, we've reordered the instructions that produce those two values for a register. And a common strategy that's used was this thing called register renaming, where we say we're going to have architectural registers. Those are the registers that are named in assembly, but those aren't actually going to be the real registers. We'll have a separate set of physical registers that are much bigger than a set of architectural registers. And by having it much bigger, we can have different versions of the same architectural register assigned to a different physical register. And with register renaming, we have this pre-processing step where we take our instructions and convert them from using architectural registers to physical registers. And when we're doing this, we can make it so each physical register is used exactly once for a write, meaning that if we want to know whether we have the current value of a physical register, that's the same as the question, do we have a value for this physical register? And also, if we're doing this pre-processing step, this is a convenient place to do any sort of other instruction pre-processing that might be convenient, and it's actually pretty common for out-of-order processors to do some extra stuff, like, for example, they might churn instructions that are complicated, like ones that use the stack, or use some weird, you know, addressing mode with a bunch of operands into multiple instructions for later steps to keep the rest of the processor simpler. So once we did this instruction translation, then we could do what I called instruction dispatch, where we have this sort of list of instructions that had been preprocessed, and we also had a list of what physical registers had a value now. And we just looked at the list of physical registers with a value, compared it to the inputs of all our candidate instructions, and tried to find instructions we could run on the what we call the execution units of the processor. And we had sort of different scenarios which could happen. So generally, our execution units would be specialized, so each instruction can only go in certain places. Like if we have two ALUs and the data cache, well, we can't put an add instruction on the data cache, but we have to put a load or store instruction on the data cache. So we'd have to look at those restrictions, and we'd also have to check if we had instructions that used the inputs that were actually available. And one thing we mentioned is that, well, you know, we're doing all this work to get this giant list of instructions we, you know, have available, but often it ends up being the case in real programs that even if we had this giant list, that the values for instructions mostly won't be available. So even if we have like five ALUs, we might only be able to find one instruction that can fit in them right now, even if we have like 50 add instructions in our list, you know, only one of them has values that are ready, because typically the way we write programs has tight dependencies, so this ends up happening. And this is something that we as programmers can control. And one way to help think about this is this idea of data flow diagrams, where we can sort of draw a graph in the graph theory, like theory course sense, where what I did is I drew sort of arrows representing dependencies between operations and ovals or something like that representing operations, and this tells us what depends on what, and we can look at that and say, okay, that we need enough time to do the longest chain we have in this graph, because we can't only do things in parallel if they don't have arrows between them, they don't have dependencies. And this led us to realize that there's some forms of code which are going to be less efficient on an out-of-order processor. So one is that, well, you know, if we're doing some commutative operation, as commonly happens, we want to expose that we can actually do two things in parallel. And if we do the naive way, we do A, add B to it, add C to it, add D to it, well, the way the processor has to run that, it has to do A plus B, then add C, then add D. But if we expose that, oh, you can do A plus B and C plus D at the same time, the processor can take advantage of that. And one way this comes up is when we're writing new statements that do math. And another special case where this comes up is with loops. Often with loops, we'll be doing some sort of sum or product or other commutative operation that accumulates a value. And in an out-of-order processor, because we do branch prediction, we can actually have the capability of doing multiple adds from different iterations of the loop at the same time, or multiplies or other operations. But this is only going to be possible if they are independent, if we don't need to do one to get the inputs to the other. And sometimes we can redesign our loops with what we call multiple accumulators, where rather than having one sum, we'll have a couple sums, and this way we'll have different loop iterations. What were originally different loop iterations will now be independent operations that can be done in parallel. And if we do this, of course, we have to do some extra work to combine at the end, so this is only really worthwhile if we have enough loop iterations, but it's a practical, useful operation, optimization. So questions about things we covered last time? Out-of-order processor operation, and applying what we learned about how out-of-order processors run things to write our programs so they had more work to do. Okay, so in that case, I'm going to talk about the quiz. So to start with quiz question one, where I messed up, I meant to write cache block versions. Instead, I wrote something that was where I decided to start my cache blocks at index 0 instead of the index we were iterating to. So version A and B were not what I intended, which is why the question just accepts all answers. But we'll talk about the intended version of the question, since I don't think, even ignoring this problem, there was consensus on the interpretation. So version A, So this is kind of like cache blocking with the fix for the indices, except these two loops, this is kind of a loop that ends up doing I equals 0, I less than n, I plus equals 1 after fixing the indexes for the I equals II issue. And these two loops do the same thing for J. So this ends up being just a funny way of writing the original code as far just with weird loop indexing. And the loop indexing, well, we don't use the data cache for that, hopefully, because hopefully I and II and JJ are all kept in registers. So this should have the exact same number of data cache misses as the original version, because it should have the exact same pattern for accessing the data cache. With version B, we actually reordered these, so this will have a slightly better pattern. So if we look at the values of I and J, which is what I did here, so first we have I equals 0, J equals 0, then I equals 0, J equals 1, I equals 1, J equals 0. We have more spatial locality in A to take advantage of than we did before. Leave that, because previously, So hopefully that should make things a little better, and we haven't really hurt our locality in B and C. More spatial locality in A, and also more spatial locality in B is probably more important. C, because C is incrementing that by. That's probably the one that I should really point out. We also have more in A, but that I think is not, arguably have more in A, but more in C is the bigger thing, because C, like previously, if we look at C here, we were previously doing 0, 0, then 0, then 1, 0, 1020 here, whereas now we're doing 0010111, and that means that now we have some chance of getting spatial locality in C where we didn't before, so that should improve our performance. So questions on version B here? So this was my, with the corrected loops, this was my intended answer. Version C was just unrolling the loop. It's the same access pattern as the original, just different indexing and some weird work to deal with. In the other case, version D was swapping the I and J loops and then doing loop unrolling. So this is a different access pattern, but it's mostly a worse one, because we were making the temporal locality in A a lot worse. Oh, with the intended version, which also missed that, but still making it a lot worse. I'll have to write that on the key that I also missed that, somehow not reading. And also it makes the in B, spatial locality in B, a bunch worse. So it's probably worse overall than the original version. Questions on question one, and sorry for, yes, I apparently didn't proofread well enough, and I assumed other people who are reading the quiz would have read that more carefully. Dude, that didn't happen. Sorry. Yeah. In version B, if we increase the block size, would we still get spatial locality improved in C? Yes, of course, there's a limit, right? If we increase the block, for cache blocking to be useful, our block size needs to correspond to the size of the cache. So if we increase the block size enough, eventually we'll have enough different rows of C we're accessing that we'll run out of space in our cache. And in practice, what people typically do to find that limit is they estimate roughly how much space is used, and then try some sizes that are usually a little smaller than that, see what works best. Does that answer your question? Okay, other questions? Okay, quiz question two, I think. Okay, I'll skip quiz question two because it looks like most people got that one. Though I have a slide on it. Unless there's questions on question two, I'll skip it. Quiz question three and question five. So this is the add labeled G. So note that the add labeled G, to do it, first we have to load two things from memory, and then we do an add. Now there's some, and these loads depend on other things that are computed in our loop. And we can do those loads from different iterations of the loop in parallel, because they're just separate loads, and we don't need R9 and R10 to do the load for the next iteration, right? So these operations, we can once we've computed these indices and pointers, we can do start the load, and we can just, and a way the processor could end up executing things, depending on when things are available, is it could compute all the indices and pointers for several iterations of the loop, so we'll have different versions of these pointer variables, and then do different loads of R9 and R10 in parallel, and also, therefore, different adds of R9 and R10 in parallel. So these can be done in parallel, because this is not the case where these are loop iteration variables. Like, we don't need the previous R9 to compute the next R9. Because we're always loading new values from memory. So these can be done in parallel, and because they can be done in parallel, already, there's no reason to add multiple accumulators to this, because we aren't actually accumulating anything, right? We're only computing one value for each iteration. There's nothing being accumulated, so we can't actually apply the multiple accumulators transformation to this code, and it's already can be done in parallel on the processor. There's no reason to try to add more parallelism to the add, maybe to other parts of the loop, but not to the add. questions on Chris, question 3, 5? Yes. Question, couldn't they refer to the same memory address? So you're asking, couldn't the moves and then refer to the same memory address, let the processor have to worry about it? Yes. So E and F, you mean, or? The store that's on line H that I'm showing on the slide. Yeah, you're saying, couldn't the store interfere with the loads? And that is possible. And I guess there's two things to say about that. So one, even if that's true, the processor could still do the loads, could speculatively do the loads and the adds, and then figure out later that load wouldn't have been correct. So processors will often do something akin to branch prediction for loads, doing loads before stores. So that's one strategy which could be used. Where basically what they'll say is they'll predict that the address we're loading from is not going to be the address we're storing to. The other thing is that the processor doesn't need to do any prediction if it computes those addresses in advance, even if it doesn't have the value to load or store. Does that answer your question? Because if it has the value, if it knows we're storing to a different address than we're loading from, it can say, well, there's no conflict here. And it can still do those in parallel. So what, as long as it can compute the addresses early, it can still do the different loads and stores in parallel. Answer your question? And I guess I would say, in practice, processors spend a lot of effort trying to avoid needing to distall loads because of a store with an unknown address, even though that is rather complicated. And again, also processors do things where you'd be surprised about what things they allow with respect to multi-core for that. So we're not talking about threading in this class, but processors often will have the stores be done in a different order in a way that might be visible on another core. And they say that, if you care about that, do that. Yeah.
Question 5 asks, after loop unrolling about part G, this will have multiple moves specifically for R9, because that's what is changed, RCX is changed. Wouldn't it help to have different R9 versions of R9?
So question, wouldn't it help to have different versions of R9? So I guess there's two answers to that. So one is that because of registry naming, there will be different versions of R9, whether you do that or not. And secondly, the two R9s from different iterations don't interact with each other. So you might have different versions, but they're not accumulators. That answer your question? Other questions? Okay. And quiz question 4 was this. It was when I looked earlier. Okay. So the thing we want to duplicate is for loop unrolling is probably duplicator transform is all this. We definitely need to duplicate E through H, because that's sort of the body of the loop. So, yeah.
I was just wondering, why would you have to duplicate F if RS and the RAX never change and R10 is always going to be the same value loaded in the memory? Because in the inner loop it never changes, so why would you have to duplicate or change that?
I agree you would not. And if you therefore answer none of the above, you should get credit. If you explain in the comments as it said. So yes, an optimization you can make here is that, oh, we're computing the same thing over and over again in this loop. Yeah, so you're right. And that's why none of the above has an explained in comments, so we can actually grade that same way. Okay, other questions? Okay. So that's on the quiz. Sorry for hopefully figure enough. Okay, so let's, some logistical notes. So there's an upcoming rotate and smooth assignment. So there's a rotate assignment and a checkpoint for the smooth assignment, which has two parts. The rotate assignment is relatively small, and the smooth assignment is relatively large. That's why the rotate assignment has to do the same time as the checkpoint for the smooth assignment, because of the assignment sizes. They originally do next Wednesday. We're going to cover a little bit of the stuff that's in smooth today and rotate today. So I wanted to extend the deadline. Originally, I was thinking extending it to next Friday, but we have the Thanksgiving break anyways, so I just extended it to just before Thanksgiving break. You don't want to be working on the week of Thanksgiving break. You are welcome to finish it earlier. But I figured you would prefer me giving you that time rather than say it's due next Friday. And there is an assignment due the Wednesday after Thanksgiving break, so. Which is going to be smooth, the later last part is smooth. So these assignments are performance homeworks. So you have an image, which is in the form of a 2D array that's stored in a row major order. So you're going to end up using something like the I times n plus j type syntax we've been looking at, or something equivalent to it. The first assignment is to rotate it. So you have an input image, and you want to produce a rotated output image. The second assignment is to do a blur of the image, where basically you just take 3x3 regions and average them, with some special cases for the corner, for the edges of the corners. The image is represented, as I said, as effectively a 2D array, but it's a flattened 2D array, so in row major order. So we'll have some dimension. It's always going to be square. So, and we'll have pixels that are represented as a struct with a red, green, blue, and alpha value, which conveniently means that pixels are 32 bits, because those values are going to be single bits. And you are given code that implements operators on these images. So here is the code for rotate. We'll talk about what RIDX is later, but RIDX is just doing some math. And this is the given code for rotate, and it rotates. I guess I'll explain what RIDX is. So RIDX is a macro. I'll talk about what macros are in a second. That given JN is I times N plus J is what it expands to. So this is doing an image rotation, and this exact indexing, and your job is to produce a faster version of this code for rotate. And a specific amount faster, there is a performance threshold that is measured on our machine. If you submit to the submission site, it will run on our machine, and you will be able to look at timings on a web page that we have set up. So typically, you could run it on the department machines or your own machine, and you'll typically get similar speedups, but the numbers will often be, specific numbers will be different. The authoritative speed is our specific machine, but you can certainly test in your own machine, and that should give you a good idea, for the most part, of whether something is helpful or not helpful. Your machine's probably similar enough, especially if you're using the same compiler. Using a different compiler could be a problem, but with the same compiler, probably similar enough. So I said that this RIDX thing expands, given I, comma, j, comma, n expands to I times n plus j. This is a preprocessor macro. We should talk a little about preprocessor macro so you understand what's happening. So preprocessor macro, you've probably seen defines maybe without the function syntax, or maybe with it. So you have a define like this, where I say, here I have double x, and this macro looks like a function, but it's not really a function, because what happens is when we're compiling a program with this, double parentheses something is going to be expanded as text before the compiler actually looks at compiling code. So here, double 100 will literally do the same thing as if I wrote 100 times 2 in the code. Like, it's not going to make a function call. There is no function. If I look at the assembly, I'm never going to see any indication that double existed. Now, I mentioned that this is sort of a text substitution, so it really is a text substitution, and in a strong way. So for example, if I have my double, and I put in 3 plus 3, well, it's going to be, x is going to be replaced with 3 plus 3, literally replaced. So we'll end up with 3 plus 3 times 2, which will not be 12. It will be 9. Because it is literally a text find and replace. So this means that when you see macros in real code, you often see what looks like excess parentheses. They aren't excess, they're actually very necessary. So people will actually write double with parentheses around the x to deal with that problem. And so the code we supply you for rotate and smooth, which originally comes from our textbook authors, does these extra parentheses. That's what it is. And the code we give you uses this macro. You don't have to. You can write it manually. But that's the code we're starting with, what you did. No one goes on with that. As I mentioned, it's going to be time and iMachine. The template we gave you will allow you to submit multiple variations on the code. So you can make different versions of the rotate function, and you can test them all with one submission. And you'll just have a list of functions, and you'll be able to know which one was faster and how fast each one was. And I would say for rotate, the way it works is that we don't give you much information about what you should do. That's your job to figure out based on what you've learned about optimizations in previous lectures and the rest of today's lecture. For smooth, we have some very specific advice that I would recommend, but the assignment's still graded on, do you get a certain speed up? So if you follow that advice and somehow don't get any speed up, well, we're not going to give you credit for following that advice, because presumably you need to figure out what you did wrong that didn't get you the speed up that other people following the advice are getting. And if you manage to get the speed up without following our advice, that's fine. But for rotate, we don't tell you much. And generally, I would say try a bunch of things. Remember to vary numbers. So like if you're doing cache blocking or loop unrolling, don't just try one size for cache blocking or one amount of loop unrolling and say, oh, didn't work, I'm done. That's not like, try a couple things before you say not doing anything. Remember that some things combine well or don't. So questions on the upcoming assignments. Okay, so our next topic is going to be, we talked about doing multiple accumulators and loop unrolling. Our next topic is going to be about what compilers do or don't do. So we have the code we've been looking at for our loop unrolling and multiple accumulators example, this sum. Now if I just take this sum function here and compile it without optimizations, I get this assembly code. And this assembly code, from a performance point of view, is horrible. We're storing A on the stack. So this code copies A from the stack. RBP is a pointer to, the frame pointer, so it's not the stack pointer, but it's related to the stack pointer. So we get A from the stack, add the offset to it, read from there. So we have these three instructions just to get an array element, and also reading from not only the array element, but the stack to get our pointer to the array. And then we add the sum and store it back on the stack. So we aren't using the summon register. So my compiler here, without optimizations, generates horrible assembly code. But, you know, if I turn on optimizations, it does a lot better. So here I use minus OS, which is optimized for size. This is usually what I do when I want to show assembly code on slides, because I like the assembly code being short. This is optimizing to make the assembly code short, which is not the same as making the assembly code fast. So I can also ask the same compiler to optimize for speed, and this is the code I ended up with optimization level 2, whatever, which 2 is just a set of optimizations that enables. And in this case, it made the loop a little, you know, not have, in this case, our optimized for size version, the loop has 2 jumps. Here it got rid of one of them, makes it just 1 jump, so the loop is a bit shorter. The array indexing in the loop is a bunch shorter, much simpler, which should be faster. As it turns out that doing a complex indexing on most x86 processors, that takes a little extra time. But, you know, this is not actually the only optimization support. So this is like an old version of GCC optimization level 2. I can like try a much newer version of GCC. And optimization level 3 says, please try really hard to optimize this. And this is what I end up with. And here, this version adds two pairs of longs at a time and loads not 16 bytes from the array. So we have these instructions that actually do multiple adds at a time. And that's, it uses that. And you know, I can tell the compiler, oh, do this, and also know that you're optimized for my particular processor, which is the Skylake version of the Intel microarchitecture, and it generates a version that does 4 adds in one instruction. So there's an instruction that adds 4 longs at a time and loads 32 bytes to do that. Also, I can tell it, please unroll my loop, and it will do that. Because we didn't have loop unrolling, but loop unrolling is actually fairly easy for the compiler to do, but I can tell it to do that. And there you go, now I have a loop unrolled version. So now we're adding 4 pairs of longs 8 times in our loop, so each iteration of this loop does 32 iterations of the original loop. Also, I could try a different compiler. So for example, if I just tell Clang to optimize for my compiler, it does a lot of loop unrolling. And the same trick of using these instructions that do a bunch of adds in one instruction. So we're going to talk more about how these instructions that do a bunch of adds at a time work. But you know, you noticed here that, oh, the compiler, it did a bunch of the it can do the loop unrolling, we did. It can do the multiple accumulators transformation, which it's doing. In this case, we have multiple accumulators here. We have different registers for 4 different registers being used, and each of those registers actually contains 4 logs. We have 16 accumulators. It can do all that stuff. Why isn't it just doing it for me? Why are we learning about this? Can't I just tell the compiler, fix that code, make it fast? And isn't it going to solve that problem for me? Because I showed you here that if I just figure out the right command line arguments, I seem to get the optimized code. And I guess there's 2 things to point out. So one thing is that the compiler didn't do this by default. None of these compilers do this by default, so you need to remember to like check your optimization flags. I note that for performance assignments, we have fixed the compiler flags at something which deliberately doesn't do certain optimizations, so you have to do them by hand. But if you're doing this in practice, in the real world, you probably should see, can I just make this fast by changing the compiler flags? Because that's probably a lot less work for you. But the other thing is that compilers sort of have things they're good at that humans aren't, and vice, and there are things that humans are good at optimizing that compilers aren't. Because compilers have to deal with some limitations that humans don't find to be a problem. We're going to talk about a bunch of them. So one of the big compiler limitations is that the compiler needs to generate code that does the same thing. You might say, why is that a problem? So the compiler needs to do this even in cases where doing the same thing handles corner cases that you looking at a code as a human would say, no one calling this function cares about that corner case. But the compiler, it can't make that assumption. It can't figure out that this is a corner case that matters versus this is a corner case that no one actually cares about in the specification of this function. So we're going to talk about probably the biggest example of this problem, that compilers are maintaining what the original code did, even in real corner cases that often don't really matter. That's aliasing. So here, I have an example of code with aliasing. So this function twiddle here, not from our textbook, it takes in two pointers to longs. So I just take for your pointer two longs, and the code I have written here, I add the second long y to the first one twice. I'm doing that by dereferencing pointers because I have pointers. And you might have this idea that, well, you know, if I do the naive thing for this code, what I'm going to end up doing is I'm going to end up loading and storing x twice. And that seems slow. So shouldn't I load x, add to it, store x? That seems like the code you want the compiler to generate. And this is the assembly for that code. In this case, I load y, add y to what itself, add that to x.
Yeah.
So code like this, you think the compiler should be able to do something like that where we don't store twice. But there's a problem. That is not code that is legal for the compiler to generate. It is not a correct implementation of this function. There is, you know, it's not that it's fast or slow, it's that it's wrong. It will give us the wrong answer sometimes. Someone tell me an example of when would we get the wrong answer from that implementation. In this case, I'm just loading y, multiplying it by 2, adding it to x.
Yeah.
Back there?
If the x is just py.
Px and py are the same thing. Yeah. So if I call this function, like with a pointer to the same variable z, then what it's going to end up doing is it should end up being the same as z plus equals z and z plus equals z. And that's going to end up multiplying z by 4, whereas the implementation I was thinking of doing here would be z plus equals 2 times z, which multiplies z times 3. So in this special case, where I call this function with px and py being the same thing, this code is wrong. And our compiler needs to be hyper aware of corner cases like this and avoid breaking the code in those cases. Because sometimes those corner cases will be things that actually matter, and you would be very unhappy if the compiler just broke your code because it said, oh, you're never going to make these two pointers point to the same thing. Why would you do that? But we as humans, we would probably know something about how this function is being used and have an idea saying, oh, it doesn't make any sense for these two things to be the same pointer, though this function's supposed to add the value twice. Doesn't, like, no one should care about this case. Something we might say as human. This case is not so clear, but in sort of a more realistic case, you'd like have a documentation for the function, and that would tell you, oh, you know, this is a case which is doesn't matter or doesn't matter. But the compiler, it just looks at your code, it has to make it do exactly what the code says, even when, you know, you probably don't actually care. So that's our, so this problem is called aliasing. It's called aliasing because the issue is that PX, star PX and star PY can be two different names for the same thing. And that's where the compiler gets in trouble, is the compiler needs to constantly worry that every single pointer value points to the same thing as every other single pointer value. All the time. Even though we as humans know that, you know, there's only certain cases when it's likely to be the case. So you might say, this is pretty contrived. This would never happen in real code. Let me give you a less contrived example of aliasing. So here I have a function where I have a matrix stored in row major form, and I'm getting the sum of each row into an array with the result for each row. And here the compiler needs to worry that maybe the way I called this function is that I did some rows, you know, some array, let's say, you know, somewhere in an array, that I passed the same array, different pointers to different parts of the same array for result and matrix. That is something the compiler needs to make work exactly as written. And if we think of what's supposed to happen there, we're kind of reading, well, we're interleaving writing to the matrix and reading from the same part of it. And this really limits what the compiler can do. In particular, one thing the compiler can't do in this case is if I call it like this, that means I can't just accumulate this sum we're adding to result of row in a register and then add it later, because I have the same overlap we had in the previous example, where I might be adding to the number, I just adding the number I need to itself. For some in the, you know, column index, I might end up doing that in some row index. And so this is a case where you'd really like the compiler to put this thing, you know, we'd like this in an index, like in a register, but the compiler is not going to be able to do that because of this aliasing issue, because it has to worry that maybe result and matrix are parts of the same array, and I need to figure out if they are, how is that going to affect this computation? So because I can't just keep it in a register without sending it back to the original array, just in case we read it back. So the compiler can't do what you would say is pretty simple, and that is just making sort of a temporary variable we can keep in a register to compute that sum and then storing that at the end. So this is a very simple optimization for us as humans that is very hard for the compiler to do because of aliasing. So I'm not saying the compiler can't do this, but if the compiler wants to do this, it's going to have to generate code that, like, checks our result and matrix pointers to different parts of the same array or not. And some compilers will do that, but that's obviously pretty complicated relative to us as humans saying, if you're calling this function, you know, like this, you're being silly, stop that. That's what we'd say, and we'd just do this change. And this means that if I write code by hand where I kind of show the compiler, oh, you should really keep sum in a, you know, register or something like that, like do it I do here, that actually ends up helping my performance a bunch. So here, this is the two versions, the performance in cycles per element. And you can see we got just a little bit of benefit with optimization level 2. If I do optimization level 3, I get a lot more benefit. And basically what happened is the compiler had other optimizations it wanted to do, like multiple accumulator type stuff, and using those instructions that add multiple values at once. And it couldn't figure out how to do that when it had to worry about all that plus equals x stuff. But when it didn't have to worry about that, it said, oh, great, we can do that now. And yeah, it's not that the compiler can't do it itself, it's just that it's a lot more complicated. It would need to generate code something like this. which some compilers might do, but you can understand why they're not going to try to do that all the time. Questions about our aliasing example. So one thing aliasing has interaction with is cache blocking. So if we think of code that uses cache blockers, so here I have cache blocking, plus I did a bunch of loop unrolling to eliminate two inner loops. And we'd like it to be the case that since I'm reusing the value after cache blocking of this index of A, then it's kept in a register. All right, that should be the same value. It's going to be better with cache blocking, but if we do this code the naive way, we'd have to load from the cache twice. Ideally, we'd only load it once and then use that value twice. We'd save a cache access. And the compiler probably can't do that for you. It probably is going to read from the cache twice because it has to worry. Maybe it's the case that this here is actually just another name for that element of A. And therefore, it could have changed between those two accesses. So I have to load it again just in case. And also, this means I have to store that value of C before I move on. I can't delay the store in any way. So what you'll commonly see people do to deal with this is something sometimes called register blocking, where I'll just explicitly keep things that are reused in local variables, because this will tell the compiler, load these once, and then use the same value, and if you have few enough variables, it should keep them in registers. If you have too many, this might cause lower your performance, because it will keep things on the stack, but if you only have a few, this will let the compiler keep things in registers when it might not otherwise be able to, because it would have to say, oh gosh, we'd love to have that in a register, but we're reusing that. It might be the same thing, I might have to reload it just in case, this write to C changed it. Questions? This aliasing. So let's do a little exercise on aliasing. So here I have some code that we take two arrays, S1 and S2, source 1 and source 2, add them into dest. And I'm saying the compiler can't just automatically generate a version of this where it unrolls it like so, where it kind of unrolls it like in this way. I'm asking which are examples of cases where we'd have to worry about a different answer. What is the compiler avoiding by not doing this transformation? And the transformation I'm doing here is I'm saying I'm going to load four values at once before I store anything, rather than load, store. Thank you. Who'd like some more time? Okay, so who thinks A would be a problem? Thinks B would be a problem? Okay. Thinks C would be a problem? Who thinks D would be a problem? Okay, so we have pretty good consensus that B would be a problem. And I guess who has no clue? Couple. So okay, so let's look at B first. So B would be a problem, and we can figure out why if we look at what happens for our first few iterations. So initially we have, you know, D is A of 1. So D of 0 is A of 1, D of 1 is A of 2. So our first two iterations of the initial loop do A of 1 equals A of 0 plus A of 0, A of 2 equals A of 1 plus A of 1. For the other loop, our first two iterations get the original A of 0 plus A of 0 and A of 1 plus A of 1, and then assign that to A of 1 and A of 2. But that means that we have a difference here. So here, the first iteration affects the second iteration in the original version. And in the new version, that's not true. That this value of A of 1, this is using the original A of 1. Whereas this is using the new A of 1. So we're going to have different values in that case. So that's why B is a problem. So B is a problem. I think none of the others are. So let's talk about them in order. So A is not a problem because the destination is a different array than the sources. So we're never reading something that has been written during the loop. And D is actually another example of that. So in D, it's true that the destination and source arrays are the same, but the destination starts at 0, and we only go up to index 1,000. So we never actually access anything that's in the sources, which are always after index 1,000. So C is a little more subtle. So for C, we're reading from A starting at index 10 and writing from A starting at index 0. And the way I've transformed the code, I read ahead by at most two things away, and so I'm always reading way further ahead than anything I've written. So in both cases, I'm never reading anything that I've written because I'm starting far enough ahead. So questions on how I figured out that only B is our problem, B is our only problem here? So one thing to note about aliasing is aliasing explains why compilers don't do cache blocking and changing loop orders for you. Because if we look at our code where we were talking initially about cache performance, even if the compiler knows what the better locality is, it has to worry, what if C and A are different parts of the same array? And because of that, it basically can't do that optimization for you without adding some extra code to like check. Do C and A overlap? If so, do something else. And some compilers might do that, but it's not very common because like that sort of analysis is it's much more complicated than just, you know, what we can do by hand and say, oh, the loop order, we have choices. Okay, so this was about compilers needing to do the same thing. So there's some other compiler limitations we'll talk about. So another limitation is that compilers generally try to work a function at a time when they're doing optimizations. They don't always do this, but if you try to do optimizations across multiple functions, this usually ends up making your compiler a lot slower. So just because most of the time you aren't happy if your compile time is like 30 seconds to 10, 20 minutes, you prefer the compiler act in this mode, but most of the time it only works a function at a time. Another thing is that the compiler doesn't actually know what the inputs to your code is. So this comes up particularly with loop unrolling. So it doesn't know, for example, if it has a loop, which goes up to n, it might not, if n is not a constant, it doesn't know if n is usually big or small. And so it doesn't know what type of optimizations would be appropriate. Also, a lot of the optimizations we've talked about make the code much bigger. And the compiler doesn't have the information to know, is it okay to make your code, your executable, a lot bigger or not? Because if we make your executable bigger all the time, it's going to take up more space, and it's going to probably run slower because we'll run out of space in our caches. So let's talk about this in loop unrolling. So in loop unrolling, we have run into two of these problems. So one of that then is that if we unroll every single loop, we're going to make our executable a ton bigger. And if we do this all the time, most of those loops don't run that much. So we're just adding stuff to put in our instruction cache without improving our performance very much. Also, if I have loops that run a small number of iterations, loop unrolling is going to make that loop slower because we're adding extra code to like deal with the leftover iterations and things like that. So, it's not actually worth unrolling those loops. It's in fact going to make our program slower. So, what we want to do is we want to unroll loops that are run a lot of iterations, and are quick to execute. And the compiler can't really tell what loops fit in that criteria. So for example here, this loop here, right? If the compiler sees this, it doesn't know, is this loop run a lot? Is the loop body something which will benefit a lot from loop unrolling because it's simple? Or is the loop overhead like a trivial percentage of our time? It can't tell that. It doesn't know what some variable typically is. It doesn't know whether some function is like a trivial thing or something that like takes 5 minutes, in which case don't bother unrolling this. So that's sort of an issue where our compiler doesn't always do loop unrolling. That's why, even though the compiler often can do it automatically. Also, sometimes the compiler might not be able to do the loop unrolling so easily. So here, why is the compiler not going to do this type of loop unrolling most likely? Why can't the compiler do this transformation here? So there's something I need to add to the transform code to make it actually equivalent. So this is not a case of the compiler doesn't know what the trade-offs are. This is a case where the compiler needs to worry about a stupid corner case that we as humans know doesn't apply. Yes? Some function can modify the sum, you're saying? So there is an issue with some function being able to modify things. The sum is not a problem, but it could modify this global variable here. And that means that this code here is incorrect because it could be the case that the global variable gets changed so we don't need to do any more loop iterations after any of the calls to some function. So we can also have issues where, in some corner cases, the compiler, might not do loop unrolling, which you would have no trouble doing. because it has to worry about silly corner cases like, I'm calling a function, I don't know what the function does. Maybe it modifies this variable I'm using. Now, also talked about the issues with loop unrolling. Most of those also apply to doing multiple accumulators. So adding multiple accumulators, it makes our code bigger. If we do that for every single loop, our program will be very big, and most of the time, adding multiple accumulators will not actually help us. And also, if we have a small number of iterations, we're actually doing like more adds or multiplies or whatever. And also, using multiple accumulators has the additional downside of using extra registers that we can't use for other things. So code around that loop that uses multiple accumulators could have to like store registers on the stack and restore them to free up space for the extra accumulators. So the compiler doesn't want to just try to use multiple accumulators for every loop. It's going to need to figure out, whether the loop is a good candidate, and often it won't have that information, but you might. Even though, yes, the compiler could do the multiple accumulators transformation itself, just like with loop unrolling, it's probably not going to, even in the cases where it could, all the time, because it doesn't know if it's helpful. It doesn't have that information. Okay, so we've talked about optimizations that we've learned that the compilers sometimes can't do or won't do for you because they don't know that they're helpful. Let's talk about some optimizations that, some additional optimizations that compilers are pretty good at. So here I have a case where I have a loop that has a function call. And this function call here, well, this function's actually pretty simple. And if we think of how this works in assembly, if I do the naive thing here, what my loop is going to do is I'm going to have some instructions to move my array index into a register for the first parameter, and the sum into a register for the second parameter, and I'm going to have a call to this addWithLimit function, and if I think of what's happening here, I have 1, 2, 3, 4 instructions that I'm running just because this is a function call. And if we look at our function here, probably I have like an add, a compare, like maybe a conditional move. Like the actual work of this function is something like 3 instructions. But to run those 3 instructions, I'm running an extra 4 instructions, some of which are pretty complicated, call and return. And what we might want to do instead is put the body of the function inside our loop. And this is called inlining. So rather than calling the function and doing all the work to call the function, I'm just going to put that code for the function directly there, changing the registers to match the variables we're actually using. And this should save roughly 4 instructions. And this is something we could do by hand. So the sort of by hand version would be I just copy the body of the function inside. And this is something the compiler could do for you too. This is a very, like loop unrolling, this is a very mechanical transformation most of the time. And it is in fact something compilers are pretty good at doing. But the compilers, won't always do it all the time. And the reason why the compilers shouldn't always do it all the time, well, one reason why, is that if we inline every single function call, well, we're just making our program a lot bigger. And if we do that, without any limitations, we'll just run out of space in our caches. And also make it have a really big executable, which you probably wouldn't like. So it turns out compilers generally will do this, but there's kind of 2 restrictions they have. So one is compilers typically have a heuristic where they're gonna guess, is inlining this worthwhile? And they'll try to figure out, is this gonna make the code a lot bigger for not much benefit? So if the function's small enough, they'll inline it. If the function's called exactly once, they might inline it, but otherwise they'll probably say, well, probably not worthwhile, but they're making a guess. They haven't actually timed your code. They don't know whether that's a good idea. Another thing compilers will generally not do with inlining is they generally won't inline across object files. And this is a technical limitation, that if add with limits defining another C file, it could change before we make the executable. So when the compiler is producing the loop, it can't just copy the code for the add with n. So it won't do it across .o files because, well, when it's producing the assembly, it doesn't have the other function. So if you want the compiler to do inlining, usually you need to arrange for it to have the code for the function that's being inlined when it's producing the assembly. There's some features compilers have that allow it to like do the inlining later, but that's not typically a default. So questions about inlining? This is function inline. So we're going to just copy the body of a function where it's called. This is something compilers will do for you when their heuristics guess that it's probably worthwhile and they have the body of the function available when they're making the assembly. Questions? Going back to our list of compiler limitations, so inlining is an example where the compiler is not going to like look very deeply into a method here. So this is where we get into the compiler's kind of function at a time. So the compiler inlining, that's going across functions, but in a very limited way. So typically the compiler is not going to like figure out, after I inline, can I simplify things, for example. That's not something the compiler is going to check. It's going to say, is the function big? Is it small? Therefore decide how to inline. It's not going to like try to figure out, you know, after I inline will things look nicer or anything like that. And also the compiler, you know, doesn't understand when you think it's okay to make the code really big versus when you don't. So it has sort of a default that, you know, typically doesn't make people angry that they're getting like a megabyte executable. That might not be what you want if you want to make some particular code fast. On inlining. Talk about one more optimization that's pretty simple. This is on removing redundant operations. So here, there's something I can do to improve the performance of this loop. Can someone tell me what it is? So this loop actually runs really slow, and this is like, and by really slow, I mean it's a big O really slow problem. Actually, that's really slow in a big O sense. Yeah. Yeah, we can take the string length function is a problem here. So if we transform the loop to only call string length once, that will improve things. And you might say, well, can't the compiler do that? And, well, if we're thinking of being the compiler, there's a function called stringlen. You have to know what that function does to know it's not going to have a different return value each time. So the compiler probably can't do that for you. And maybe even if you do know what stringlen does, then in order to do this, you need to be able to check all this code here and make sure it won't change the string. Which, in this case, is doable, but it would be easy to have it be very hard to figure that out. Okay. So let's talk about other case of some redundant operations. What's something we can do here to simplify this? And the issue is that I'm comparing I plus amount to n a lot of times. Is there some way I can avoid that? Avoid doing that as much as I am. You're saying put I plus amount in the for loop? So what's the purpose of that?
So basically,
So you want to put, so I guess what you're thinking, you want to put this in the for loop because you're saying this looks an awful lot like this, right? That's what you're saying? And I think that's a good insight, right? It seems like they're both doing the same work, kind of. Yeah. You got it?
I was just going to say make it separate so you're only doing the computation once.
Make it separate. So what do you mean by separate? Which isn't a different variable? Okay, you want to have a separate variable to track I plus amount. That's not a horrible idea. I don't think it actually saves us any operations because we have to add to keep track of it. So it's so probably a wash, maybe not. Yeah.
On this
motorized,
you can keep track of n minus amount, like pre-calculate that before you
can save. Okay, you could say we could calculate n minus amount to avoid doing as much arithmetic. I agree, that would be helpful. There's something better we can do. But that's a good idea, right? We could just change this to I and minus amount, and we could have this be pre-calculated. But there's something even better we can do. Yeah. I put that in the for loop? Okay, so. So I'm gonna put that in the for loop, so I'm gonna have for I is less than n minus amount. But isn't this not equivalent to our current for loop? So the question is, so I like this idea, but how is this equivalent to the existing for loop, right? The existing for loop still goes up to n. Okay, so an observation we can make is that we kind of have two cases here. We have when I is less than n minus amount, we're doing the line, that line. And then for the rest of the array, once I is greater than or equal to n minus amount, it's going to stay that way up until n. So we have a second case where I is greater than or equal to n minus amount and less than n, where we're doing the second operation. And what I can do is I can turn these into two separate loops, which will look like this. And now I have I've eliminated an if statement. By just making it into my two loop comparisons. So this eliminated some comparisons. Also, this makes it easier to do other optimizations on this loop now, because now I have a nice loop for loop unrolling. Two great loops that I can do loop unrolling on. Whereas previously I could do loop unrolling, but the stuff in the loop was very complicated. Now it's very simple. So by doing this transformation, I have two loops, but they're a lot simpler, and that's going to let me do a lot of other optimizations. And this is something where a compiler could do this, but it's tricky because the compiler like needs to know about what amount is to figure this out. No problem. Okay, so let's do. This question in our last minutes. Okay, since we only have a minute, I'll take the first question is which of these increase the size of machine code? It's the amount of machine code we have. So who thinks cache blocking is likely to do that? Okay. So I would say who thinks cache blocking is not likely to do that? Okay, so we have either it does or no opinion. So I would say cache blocking is the machine code, yes. And that's because we have more complicated loop indexing. That's more code. Fixed function inlining is likely to increase the amount of machine code we have. Who thinks it's not likely to increase it? So we have a mix here. So I would say function inlining is likely to increase the amount of machine code because we probably still have the function. I would say yes if we still have the original function. Still have function, the function, or it's in line multiple times. So there are cases when it makes it smaller, but if the function's called multiple times, in line both times, it's probably more code. How about loop unrolling? Who thinks this increases the amount of machine code we have? Thinks it does not. Okay, so most people say increases it, or machine code. I would say movement calculation outside of the loop probably doesn't do anything for the machine code size, roughly. And multiple accumulators increases the machine code size because there's extra code to add up the accumulators at the end. And I think we're out of time here, but so next time we'll look at the second part of this question and talk about those instructions we kind of alluded to, which add multiple values at a time and how they work, which is going to be the second part of